when we were racing, I got this weed stuck on my paddle, and it was really long, like it was probably a couple meters long, and it hit the girl in front of me in the back, and pieces of weed scattered all over the boat, and I had this, like, flash of a thought of, like, I can't believe this is happening to me in the semifinal of the Olympics, and then, but because I was really prepared, I was able to just shift it, like, immediately into, like, okay, well, just focus on, like, lifting the blade a little bit higher, harder, ignoring it when it came into my line of sight. And, like, every stroke, it just wrapped around the blade, so it got less and less of an impediment. But if I hadn't been that prepared, or if I hadn't had sort of a calmness around my racing setting.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I'm a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. Today, I interview Kamini Jain, someone who's shown leadership both in athletic success as well as a coach. Two-time Olympic finalist in the kayak fours in 2004, multiple-time world champion and coach in dragon boat and world sprint outrigger canoe, master's degrees in both physiology and in leadership, and is the owner of Right Angle Performance, a paddle sport service company in Vancouver. Kamini's amazing insights. Just imagine you're training 4 years for an event, and in the semifinals, you catch a weed on your paddle during the race, and how she gets through that and kind of how she resets herself mentally, really impressive. And being a leader, not always easy. She talks about how she had to make tough choices in crew selection, and it's a good glimpse into the sometimes the difficult decision making leaders are faced, but how she does that with being straightforward and just being honest. I hope you enjoy this interview.
Oh, I feel like my career has been quite a long journey. I guess it's been 35 years of journeying so far. My kayak career was quite a bumpy road for a while. I feel like I got quite successful quickly, but then got an injury that really set me back in the way that injuries do when you have decided to define yourself by a certain thing. So I was a paddler, and then I wasn't a paddler, which then meant I ate too much peanut butter, and I gained a bunch of weight, and I got really depressed. And then when I got better, it took a while to get back out of it. But, you know, bit by bit, get back out of it. Then I tore an ACL, which actually ended up probably being my saving grace, because now I had to be a paddler still because I didn't have any knees, so I couldn't be a runner. And I also met my coach, Alan Carlson, who you've spoken to, who trained a he's a physiologist, who trained me in a different way. So he trained me to get more speed. He trained me to be able to get off the start line faster, which was always my deficit. So that got me onto the national team within a year working with him. And then had some good years through there, and then moved into coaching, dragon boat, outrigger canoe, a little bit of kayak, and that's been a great road to the Canadian national team coaching and various outrigger events, and keep continuing to race all the way through because, you know, coaching and racing together is a really good partnership. Obviously, you get better at both by doing both.
At what point did you have your sights set on the Olympic team?
Well, when I was, anybody who's about my age or older will remember Chariots of Fire, or you should remember it even if you're much younger, because you should watch it if you haven't. Chariots of Fire, 1981 Academy Award winning movie. I watched that with my mom. She took me to the theater, and my mom was so, you know, I got the impression that she thought that the Olympians were really accomplished, like it was a really noble thing to do. And so that set it first in my head as something that was valuable. And then I grew up next to some twins, and their dad had been a high jumper, and they would say how he'd missed the Olympic team by an inch. And he was so amazing, he could jump over the house. And, you know, they were, you know, to impress them, you know, sort of ingrained in my head further that if they are impressed, it must be a good goal. And then I just love sports, so I sort of trying all these different sports, and when I found kayak, it just suited my analytical sort of technical mind, plus my introverted self, where I could just be in a boat on my own, yet still have crew boats and teams to do with some really close friends. So it ended up, you know, teaching me how to socialize as well as perform. So, yeah, I'd really sort of had that in my mind from a young age somehow.
And so you mentioned, okay, so you made the team in the Olympic team in 2004.
Yeah.
So before that, in the previous cycle with 96, what was your relation to, kind of what were your relation, your aspirations to the national team at that time?
Well, I've sat on a sort of a fence for a while, but, you know, at that time, there's more development, and it's a better system now than it was then to have development teams and have sort of feeding programs. Then you were either on or you were off. And if you were off, you just went back to your club coach and you worked on things, which often was, in my experience, the most nurturing environment anyway was the club team. National team is basically go out there and perform. Club coaches are the ones who bring you up and along. So I just sat on the fringe. I'd gotten to the fringe before, you know, my injury at 19, you know, and then I got myself back to the fringe by about, you know, 96, 97.
Phrase you used, you said that working with Alan helped you to make the national team within 1 year. And so clearly you were fast before, but you made some kind of significant jump in speed. And so take us through that. What was that like working with Alan and getting maybe a different perspective, different coaching, and then clearly you're excelling through it.
Yeah, well, what, you know, what he recognized, and what, I mean, what I'd known forever is that I had this really good finish, but it's 500 meter racing. At that point, there was only 500 meter racing. Now there's 200,000, 500. So 500 meter racing requires a really good start and a really good finish, but I just had a really good finish. So I'd run out of real estate and, he recognized that that was actually trainable. So all the training that I'd been doing to that point made my finish better and better and better. It had a bit of start work on it, but nothing to the extent of what he then had me do. So, I mean, it was magical for me to have found him and for him to have thought that it would be fun to work with me. So what he said was, what I always remember him saying was, we'll train you like Ben Johnson without the drugs. So I did these really, really short pieces. In doing short pieces, like three strokes every minute, and just three strokes every minute, like just over and over and over with all that rest, right? But because they were short, they had to be short workouts. So a workout would be a total of 45 minutes. Because they were short workouts, there'd be tons of them. So sometimes I would have like six workouts in a day where I'd go in and out and in and out. Those were very agitated days. What that meant was that all of a sudden I could get off the start line. You know, not off the start line like a world champion gets off the start line, but off the start line well enough to now make it onto the national team, having me do.
Okay, so it seems like the match, as far as Alan coaching and you as an athlete being coachable, it seems like there was probably a very strong match there.
Yeah, and it was, and it really brought to my attention going forward that an athlete shouldn't just do the workout. An athlete should understand why he or she is doing the workout, because in that way they actually continually fulfill sort of the brief of the workout, because they always know. Like a six-minute piece can be something in one kind of workout. A six-minute piece can be a completely different physiological goal in another kind of workout. So if an athlete really understands how to differentiate, they're going to be better.
Okay. And so... What habits or behavior do you think set you apart and allowed you to become an elite athlete from either yourself unable to do it before or someone else who might not have that habit or behavior?
Yeah, I think, I think a main thing is that it wasn't a choice. There were lots of times where I thought, well, maybe there's other things that I should be doing. I think there were, but I think I very quickly pushed them out because it had become somewhat of an obsession. And I think a lot of high performers, people who are trying to, you know, get into a smaller echelon of performers will have that same thing as it's not a choice anymore. It's a sort of a passion. It's kind of an obsession. It's kind of, if I stop now before I make it, then I will always regret it. What else can I do? I haven't done this. I haven't done that. And even at the end, you know, a career runs out of time, basically, because maybe our bodies run out of working years. But there's always something more that can be done. There's always something that can be done differently. So that sort of searching of, you know, I haven't exhausted all the possibilities yet. And, you know, I wish I had 10 more years. I wish I, you know, and I think a lot of people think that when they look back, you know, as athletes, we just have that end point where we're just done. But now it's like, if I knew then what I know now. So it's just a matter of finding new resources and learning more and just being a little bit, you know, obsessed or passionate or whatever the, obsessed is a negative word, passionate is a positive word, about keeping going until I got what I got, at least what as much out of it as I could.
And so when you're coaching athletes and they're hitting barriers or they're coming against, plateauing, how do you handle, you know, trying to get your athletes through those kinds of barriers?
I mean, I would say that every athlete who's hitting a barrier or is going to have a different reason for hitting that barrier. So it would be, you know, delving into it with that individual. And, you know, if we're looking at a dragon boat athlete or a sort of what I'd call, you know, one of those, the kind of athletes like we are as adults where we do it outside. We do it, but we still have our full-time job. We might have our kids. We might have, you know, various other commitments. It is, are you actually doing enough work to be able to overcome the level that you're at? Because as we get better, we need to put more into it. You can't put the same into it and expect to get better. So that can be a reason for plateauing. But otherwise, there's all sorts of reasons. There's motivation. There's different technical things. There's different mindset. Like, I had a huge epiphany with my mindset at one point by a sports psychologist that was just learning how to sort of release my analytical self when I went to race, because you can't perform and analyze at the same time. So differentiating those thought processes. So is somebody plateauing because they can't race? Is somebody plateauing because they don't train well? Do they need better training partners? You know, all sorts of different things, but it's quite an individual journey to find out what those reasons are and whether they can be surmounted.
Okay, very interesting. And so what about when someone is, and you yourself have been in this position many times, when you're doing the next stroke, and it's just blinding pain, and you want to stop, how might you get through that or coach someone through that? What's your way? What's your mental way?
Yeah, well, what I tend to focus on, so because it works for me, so I have my athletes focus on it, is, you know, if the idea of your pain is going to come into your head, you can't say, I'm not going to feel the pain. You need to replace it with something else. So I do like to say exactly what you just said, this stroke, which is actually something I'd first heard from Don Irvine, this stroke. He used to tell us that when we were racing at the end. I believe you've spoken with him.
Yeah.
But replace it with something. So replace it with something technical. Like when at the end of a dragon boat race, people often tend to do what I call turtling, which is their posture totally fades, collapses. So the way to minimize turtling is to really check in on the rotation through your upper back, make sure that that's moving well, keeps your hand positions good. So it could be that. So think about the rotation. It could be something that's more visually motivating, like reaching for the finish line. So just replacing the negative with the positive. Things like, oh, my teammates want me to be good, you know, that sort of thing, I don't think works. It's like very self-centered, defined way of thinking that you fine-tune in practice. So every time that I hurt in practice, I think about this. Make it an automatic association with, you know, when I hear such and such a word, finish, or when I know I have, you know, 100 meters left, you know, when you don't have a drummer, I'm going to think this, I'm going to think that, I'm going to think this, so that everything is scripted and defined and practiced so that it's automatic.
Okay, and so and that's interesting when you're in the grind. So you're turning whatever is negative, the pain, into something positive. So you're thinking about the finish line. Now, how about the time, I can't help but think the times you're going out six times in a day and you're working on these short bursts over and over and over and over and over, and over again, and it's maybe late in the day and you've done five workouts and you're at home and you don't want to go up for the sixth. I imagine you might have had feelings like this. So how did you get, what kind of attitude or did you take on to get through that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember that generally being a challenge because it was what I was doing. And
yeah,
it was defined for me. Alan had told me, if I do this, this will be good, right? So it was pretty straightforward. That wasn't a case where I had a training group then. There was a number of years where I trained with Alan that I trained by myself. A training group always helps. Like now I barely will ever go out without a training group. Training group helps for most people. Obviously there were times I didn't want to go and you drag your ass out. And then when you're out there, you go, well, I'm not going to waste the time. One thing that I used to say to myself all the time is I'm never going to get this stroke back. So I need to do this stroke the best I can do because I'm never going to get it back.
Okay.
Even though I've probably done like hundreds of thousands of strokes in my life. But each staying in the moment, right? Each one is important. Don't waste a single one.
You'd stated that, you know, the second time when you're going through the cycle for the Olympic team, now that you were known, you'd spent more time on the mental aspect because there was more pressure. And I'm wondering if you can take us through kind of what that felt like and what it, how you dealt with that pressure mentally.
I'm not sure if I remember there being more pressure. When I think of differentiating between the two Olympics, I remember feeling a lot more supported in the second Olympics. Into the trials for the first Olympics, or I had a couple of people say things like, do you know you have to try out? You know, those sort of things. Sort of thing like, oh, yeah, you know, she's got a pipe dream somewhere in there. But then the second time I had this community in North Van that actually had some clinics that helped me raise money to buy a new K1, and the club supported me and had a fundraiser. So it started to become something that they were backing a potentially winning horse rather than not even noticing. And I'm not very outgoing, so it wasn't like a published, like, declared my goals to the world, because you don't want to declare your goals when you think that you might fail, that there's a good chance you're going to fail, that you've always failed before. But the second time around, when I had a success behind me, then it was a bit of a different story, plus being on the national team each of the years before that. So, you know, in that way, I think I was more prepared. I mean, I was more prepared because I had 4 years, 3 years of world championships in between. So, yeah, I don't think it was more pressure. I think it might have been a little less, if it's possible to be less. I mean, when you go and race, you're putting everything on, like, one weekend of racing. And if you don't do a good weekend of racing, then that's it.
Yeah. And so how did that add more tension, more pressure when there's an Olympics coming up versus a world championship?
Yeah, and I got to say that racing in Olympic trials is way harder than racing in Olympics mentally.
What?
Because you have everything to lose. I mean, granted, once you do have a lot to win at the Olympics, but you have a lot to lose at Olympic trials. I never quite thought of it that way, but yeah, and you also know at Olympic trials what you should be doing. So it's a lot more pressure there. And it's individuals instead of a crew boat. Whether that's more or less pressure is, you know, arguable.
Okay, so how did you deal with the pressure at trials then? If that sounds like that's perhaps the most pressure-filled situations you had.
Yeah, I think you just, I mean, you've raced, by the time somebody gets to an Olympic trials, they've raced all the way through their youth, for the most part, raced, every level there is to race nationals, like so many races that, yeah, you kind of have your coping mechanisms refined, I would say, or as, you know, well-practiced as far as keeping focused, having your visualization techniques, having your day really well mapped out, knowing exactly what you're going to do when, being able to deal with things that might not go quite the way you want it to go. You don't show up not without having the whole build up to it.
And so if you can take us through this, you know, without giving away any state secrets here, how you might map out your day or what visualization looks, what that looks like to you?
Okay, well, I'll come more into modern day because I was sure I was just going way back in my brain there to think of Olympic trials.
Love it, by the way.
I was almost going to go into some sort of crisis of like pressure, but yeah, that was a long time ago. You get up in the morning, you know what you're going to eat, you got the food already, right? You know what you're going to pack in your lunch, you know what time you have to be somewhere. Everything, you know, exactly what you're going to do for your warm-up, you know what you're going to wear. Like, I always have, I got my lucky shorts and, I always wear the same hat and, you got everything put aside, like get everything ready the day before, even if it's not rushed in the morning, it's just the less to think about the next day, the better. As a coach, I always have all the rosters and all that sort of stuff. So it's just having everything prepared, having thought through when I'm training a team or training myself. I try to make sure that we've done enough coursework, enough really race-specific work, enough start work, that all of the patterning that we need to do the race has been visualized many, many, many times over just by preparing for practices and then executing in practices. So just being able to sit and go through a race, not overly, not obsessively. That's one of the things I learned when I was younger, is don't obsessively ever visualize. Just go through it really optimistically, really accurately, like wearing the jersey, all that sort of stuff. And then, get on with the day. But just really schedule things out.
So it's interesting to me, Kamini, that, you're saying that the time trials are very stressful and that each of the athletes is doing the time trial to make the team individually in a solo boat. And then they're being put into a team of four for the Olympics. And so that's an interesting dynamic to me, where it's kind of done on the basis of an individual performance, but then racing on the big stage as a team. So I was wondering how that dynamic looked like to you.
Yeah, that is a very, very difficult dynamic. And the, the reason being is sort of quite a sort of cutthroat environment, as I was saying, and you were just saying, go through these trials as individuals. And the people who are able to thrive on an individual basis or survive on an individual basis are the ones that stay in the sport long enough and move up high enough to be able to make it into these Olympic crew boats. So I don't think there is at this time either, but at that time there definitely wasn't a way to just be a really good crew boat paddler and be recognized as such and make it into a crew. You had to at first get a minimum singles performance, which was about top six. Sometimes it was just top four automatically in the boat, other times it was top six, and then you go into a pool and then the crew gets chosen from there. But what it does get is it gets holes in our skill set. So we've been doing this since we were children, right? You get this group of people who've been doing it since they're children, and there's holes in our skill set when it comes to teamwork, when it comes to problem solving and conflict resolution and certain things that we need to be able to do as crew paddlers. So that's a challenge. The way to surmount it would be to have a coach that understands that, is able to be integrated enough into the culture and the
of the team or aware enough of what's happening within the team to be able to fill that gap and give that leadership, because the coach is an adult. Not that we weren't adults, but now the coach is a little bit reserved or set aside from that process. So it was challenging that way, to be able to try to maximize our performance in Akrubo and minimize our stress and conflict. So when it came to coaching Dragon Boat, that became a really, really important part for me, is how can I, as a leader, manage, first of all, get these athletes who are so high, like not these athletes, but get athletes who are high achieving and highly motivated, but also get them working within a template that has really good team dynamics. So being able to select athletes based on their physicality, but also being able to either develop or manage team working skills. So that was really my mandate when I came in, is I want every athlete to feel, you know, empowered and to have the team have a good energy as much as I possibly can. And that was informed by this sort of K4 reality of more conflict.
Wow, that's interesting. And so today, you know, moving into the modern day where you're training and coaching as well, you're actively identifying people not only that are, as you say, have a good physicality that might be suited to your team, to the sport, you're also looking at the role they play in the bigger whole.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, if there is, you know, if there's two equal athletes, and this is a situation I had a lot on the Premier Mixed National Team, because that was a matter, when I was coaching it, it was 12 men in the boat and only eight women. So that was a matter of really picking straws. And, you know, mostly the differentiation came in who was, like, technically super precise, because for the most part, with that small upper echelon, they were good team players already. And dragon boaters are different than dragon boaters are kayakers. We were kids, like, we were raised through a system. We were raised in this, in a certain system that didn't necessarily teach us everything. Dragon boat isn't that environment. So dragon boat is easier to find team players. It's easier to structure a good team. And I'm not saying that I'm not saying that my kayak teammates weren't awesome people and that we weren't really good friends and had a good time together. It's just that there were some challenges with certain aspects of teamwork, because I don't think that we had the skill sets as just ourselves that we needed to negotiate such a high stressful environment.
You know, sometimes as coaches, we're making hard decisions. It's part of the job, unpleasant part of the job, but it's necessary, you know, as part of the whole. And I think you have an interesting story about swapping out teammates and trying to formulate a crew for a final. And I'm wondering if you can take us through that.
Yeah, probably most dragon boat coaches or any crew boat coaches can have endless stories about the choices that we've had to make, but there's, you know, some that define us maybe a little bit more than others, or that haunt us, or the case may be, you know. So this was Worlds in 2009, which were in Prague, and I was coaching the Premier Mixed team and the Premier Open, which is also Premier Men's team. So Open is men's and Dragon Boat. So that was a time where Canadian team was picked based on a race-off, so it was basically the False Creek team that was being represented there, not a Canada-wide team. But I decided with the Open team to sort of launch into this idea of making a more national team program, so I had some men from all over the country. But the mixed team was still False Creek. So we went through the event, and we weren't really pleased, I think as a whole team, I don't just think me as a coach, but we weren't really pleased with our 2,200 meter results. So it was coming up to the 500, and I had this thought that I could add some of the men from the non-False Creek members of the men's team into the mixed team to see if that would increase our level. But, you know, the stress with that is, one, is that going to change the team dynamic and not make a difference? versus is their physicality and their strength going to override that potential and make us faster. So I asked the team. I had some mixed comments on it. And that's the challenge is I like to ask a team, but I want the team to make sure that they understand that that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to do what they say because, you know, there's 20 of them and they're all going to say different things anyway. But I chose to put the men in. So I put in three men and we won the race, which was unbelievable. So in a performance aspect, that was a good choice to make. I think a lot of the paddlers felt like that was a good choice to make, but there was some backlash. There was some backlash, definitely. And that lasted for a while with a number of people. So, yeah, but that's what happens with decisions. You make them, and you make the best informed decision you can. You try to be fair with it. And in that case, I chose to be fairest to the highest performing athletes and give them the chance to have a better performance. And that is what happens.
Yeah, and so as a coach, you know, sometimes we have to be able to handle criticism. And so how did you handle that or in any other situation? How do you handle those types of situations?
I think you just do. You just go, well, I am somebody who really thinks through my decisions very, very carefully, meticulously, for a long, long time before I make them, and don't typically make a decision that impacts others quickly. So, you know, you do the best you can, and if somebody chooses to be your athlete, they got to choose to live with your decision, or they can move on and choose a different leader or coach. And some will like it and some won't. That's just the nature of it.
How do you handle, you know, with those who are on shore and may not be in that race? How do you handle that decision as far as they go?
I mean, every coach has a hard time with who they're going to leave on shore. It's a hard time mm-hmm. regardless. In this time, it was particularly hard because it wasn't, two of the paddlers took it really well and one didn't. You know, in other situations, I've spared paddlers where one doesn't handle it well. There's always, you try to teach people, you try to manage expectations, and that's the challenge in this situation was that expectations were changed, and I understand the challenge with that. If I had to do it again, maybe I wouldn't. It is hard to say. I don't like changing what people's expectations are, but I do like to define their expectations in that people will spare, and it could be you. You know, you just got to put in everything you can not to be on the cusp. I did have a kayak coach once say, when I first made the national team, I was the last person to make it on to the karting cycle, and he said,
okay,
it's better to be on the fence than off on the other side.
Oh.
So, okay. But then somebody else said, Don Irvine said, when I was a younger dragon boater, he said to the team, he said, don't be on the fence. Be like well onto the team. Make it not a question. Right?
Oh, so, interesting.
An athlete has to be prepared. Either get yourself into the middle or the top of the pack, or perhaps you're going to spare.
And so
it's better to spare for a team you're on than not to make the team at all. You just get better the next year, right?
Right, right. It's motivation. One of the interesting taglines for right angle performance is, if you want to be a champion, you need to be coached by a champion. And so in light of what we're talking about, what does that look like to you?
Well, I think that... If somebody, I think being, following somebody or choosing somebody to be led by involves trusting that they know what they're doing. It involves them having a certain, you know, success rate or resume or something that sort of backs up that it's tried and true. Everything they're asking you to do has been they have done, and they've had success in doing it. So in that way, the more experienced a leader or coach can be, they might not necessarily be better at presenting their message. They might not necessarily have a better message.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have a message you can trust as something that works.
Okay.
And trusting your coach, trusting your choices is key to being able to get out of them what you can.
Man, this is so good. And so as we were talking, you had an interesting story about sort of focus and preparation, and I thought it was a good kind of encapsulation of what good coaching, what good training does. And I wonder if you can take us through that.
Yeah. So, it's one of the things as, Olympians or people who've started athletics as children or, have trained to the extent that one does to get anywhere near the Olympics is that we work our mindset a lot. We work our details a lot. So when we get into races, we can feel like we're very good at controlling what we can control and not control and not control what we can't control. That wasn't the right sentence, but
yeah, we got it.
So, which is something that other athletes that are less have less opportunities, don't train as often, or have less years behind them need to learn in a bit more of an academic sense versus through the trial and error of the multiple races that a young person does. So from a more academic sense, it becomes learn your details, race, keep a calm mind. So in this situation, it was the semifinal of the 2004 Olympics in Athens, and we were racing in K4, and I was three seats. So we do this race, and what was in Athens, they had, like all lakes in the summer, like the weeds grow, right? So they'd cut the weeds, but they hadn't been able to get them all out. So there were little weeds floating here and there. So we start our race, and about halfway through, I caught this weed on my paddle. It's on the right side blade, and it was about 2 meters long. So I took the stroke, and when I swung forward, it hit the back of my teammate in front of me. And then I go in the water, and then the next I go to lift it out. It's really heavy, like heavier than usual, and then swing it forward, and it's still there. And I had this fleeting moment of, I can't believe this is happening to me in the semifinal of the Olympics. And then, lucky for me, like right away, I was able to shift my mind into going, okay, well, what's the solution? Like I was calm enough to go, okay, I'm going to make sure I lift my blade a little bit stronger on the exit, and I'm going to ignore the weed as it comes into my line of sight. And then every stroke, it just wrapped around the blade more and more, like the shaft more and more, until it was just super short because it was all wrapped around. But if I wasn't able to shift in that micro, like right at that moment, right away, things could have gone quite a bit differently in that situation. So after that, I was pretty distraught. We barely made it into the semi, so I had that flash of it's all my fault and the weed. But since we did, then I was able to celebrate the thought that I actually was able to overcome that potentially awful obstacle.
So through your mind, really did flash the thought, I can't believe this is happening to me at the semifinals of the Olympics.
Yeah, and you know, when we have a thought doesn't take as long as it does to say a whole sentence.
But
K4 takes a fraction of a second. So that was the flash through the brain, and then the next flash was like, okay, now what do I do with it? So, and that's, a key learning. We often hold on to thoughts when we race. Like, and if you watch a dog run through the park, wipes out on a stick, on a branch or whatever, just stands up and keeps going, right? Whereas we would sit there and go, oh my God, I'm so clumsy, I tripped on a branch. So when we race, we need to be able to just make a mistake and move on, or have an obstacle. That wasn't a mistake, that was an obstacle. Have an obstacle and move on.
Wow, yes, that's right. And so how many strokes did that affect you for?
Oh, half the race, 250 meters.
Wow.
And I had to call things, too, for my seat, too. So it's just like, okay, moving on, right?
Must have felt good when it was gone.
Well, I ripped it off as soon as we got in. Ripped it off, and then I was like, oh, I should have kept that.
Oh, it was still on when you got off.
Yeah, it just was all wrapped around the shaft right where the blade was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wouldn't knock off, just because it just was so long. That nice circular way of the kayak stroke, right? It just wraps and wraps and wraps.
Yeah. And so you've talked about your kayak coach, Don Irvine, and Alan. So how might you sum up kind of the effect of coaching on your life and your athletic career or just your life in general?
Yeah. So actually, as I've been talking through this, I've had two things that have come to mind for my friend Jackie Weber. We just lost her, and it's the hugest loss that I can possibly imagine for the community and myself as a really good friend. But two things, when you talk about superstition, what she used to do is she used to turn her paddle upside down. This was in when we raced War Canoe. She turned her paddle upside down and wet the handle. And I do that to this day. So that's the superstition that I do. I turn my handle upside down, and I wet the handle in a dragon boat race. And in practice, like it's just because she was doing it, so I was doing it. Jackie was somebody that I followed through thick and thin, like her habits. She used to speak she went through a phase where she spoke in a Texan accent, and the rest of us had to make sure that we didn't get that by accident. You know, she led us through the trouble, but she also led me through a lot of ways that I think about coaching. The other thing I thought about when you were asking me about pleasing the team, as she told me once, and it might have actually been after that time in Prague, she said, you can only please 80% of the people. Just only try to please the 80%. Don't worry about the other 20. So she had all this wisdom for everything. She's the one who taught me, learn everybody's names at the beginning of a camp, and this is how you do it. And all these ways of being that have made such a huge difference. I coached somebody in B1 the other day, and everything that I told her was what I'd learned from Jackie. Won World Sprints in 1991, and we were roommates at the time, and then she taught me V1, and she's so detailed in every little bit about process, following process, making sure you cover every detail that you can to be ready, which is paramount in V1 where you're steering your own boat and wind conditions and all that sort of stuff. So, and I had valued her every step of the way, every time that I did something that she had taught me. I was just like, yeah, that was from Jackie, and it's just such a huge loss for us.
Yeah, I'm sorry to you, and I knew her too. And so do you feel like in some way, if I can ask this, she lives on in your paddling and your coaching?
I guess so. I mean, I'll come to the stage of feeling that at some point. Right now, I just feel the loss, and I feel a bit guilty that I have all this stuff that I can share that I got from her. But she definitely has impacted so many people, in such a positive way.
Yeah, and the community is hurting, and I suppose that's your way of honoring her too.
Yeah, thank you.